This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
What if we really have wrecked the planet, with massive casualties coming in the next generation? That would be really inconvenient. But get ready for authority to soothe you again about the real risk of extreme climate change. The awful facts and witnesses are all lined up by our next guest. David Spratt is best known as the author of the book and blog Climate Code Red. He is with the Breakthrough National Center for Climate Restoration in Australia. And I spoke with David on Radio EcoShock in 2014 and 2016. Since then, he and co-author Ian Dunlop have updated their devastating critique of climate science called What Lies Beneath? The Inside Story of Political Failure and Scientific Reticence on Climate Change's Existential Risks. From Melbourne, David, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Alex. Great to be with you and your community of listeners.
Yes, your update to What Lies Beneath has a foreword by a person I think is one of the godlike figures of climate science, Germany's Professor Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber. He's the founding director of the famous Potsdam Institute, among other things. So Schellenhuber writes, quote, climate change is now reaching the end game where very soon humanity must choose between taking unprecedented action or accepting that it has been left too late and bear the consequences. Now, David, I'm in the camp that I think we're already at or past that critical decision point, and it has been left too late. What do you think?
Well, look, I think Schellenhuber's voice is really important. As you say, he's one of the eminent climate scientists in the world and perhaps the world's most politically connected. He is advisor to the European Union, to Chancellor Merkel, and indeed has spent a lot of time with Pope Francis. So his voice has a great deal of authority. And the fact that he wrote the foreword to our book is important because it says to the rest of the scientific community, as he says in his foreword, that what we're saying is correct. And as non-scientists, it's always difficult to intervene and write about the science community in a critical way. So I think that's important. Look, he has used the phrase endgame, which I think is really pertinent. We know in chess that means that you are close to the end and some big decisions have got to be made and there's not a lot of moves left on the board, and that's absolutely correct. If we really threw everything at this, if we thought that this was an emergency in the way that we deal with floods and fires and actually put the normal working of society a bit to one side to deal with the problem, I think we could probably get out of it. But the way the political process is going at the moment, one can't be too optimistic.
So going the way we are going, what kind of warming over pre-industrial times do you expect by 2050 or 2100?
Well, look, I think the first step in that is to look at the Paris Agreement in 2015, which was widely lauded at the time. I think since then people have become more sanguine and slightly depressed about the process. And the Paris voluntary unenforceable commitments by nations at the moment would add up to around 3.4 degrees of warming. But what we must understand is that, and this is the problem with the IPCC report, that figure does not include any of the carbon cycle feedbacks, the weakening of some of our climate systems such as permafrost and Amazon land-based stores of carbon. If those feedbacks are taken into account, it's probably closer to 5. So on the Paris course, we're heading to somewhere between 3.5 and 5. Will we do better or worse than that? That's another question.
That's pretty worrying. All right. Now, I'd like to go through a few of the signs of institutional blindness that you list in the What Lies Beneath report. For example, Schellenhuber starts with the probability obsession. What is that?
This comes to really the core issue here. If you look at the work of the IPCC over more than 20 years, which is really an assembly of individual pieces of climate research, from the beginning, the IPCC has always had a bias towards what climate models, computer models of the climate think. Now, those models are far from perfect. One of the things they cannot do is properly model what are called non-linear changes in the system, where parts of our climate system, whether it be ice in the Antarctic, whether it be permafrost, whether it be the Amazon or something else, system change very rapidly. So the models that the IPCC use are always conservative, and they do not deal with those big nonlinear events. And the other option is to learn from history, because we have a very rich history of our climate in the study of paleoclimatology. And that would tell us that, for example, at the moment we have 410 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. That's 50% higher than it's been in the last million years. And IPCC science would say, oh, well, look, that's heading towards 2 degrees. But if you look at the paleoclimate work, and we look back in history, the last time we had this amount of carbon dioxide in the air, which was 3.5 million years ago in a period called the mid-Pliocene, warming was 3 to 4 degrees above pre-industrial, and sea levels are 25 metres higher. So the essence of the problem is that the IPCC process downplays and ignores our climate history in favour of models which are not adequate to deal with future changes in the climate system.
Well, sure. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, it was founded in 1988 to advise governments on climate change. How have their predictions and assessments held up over time?
Well, in the short term, they haven't been too bad, but they've always been a bit on the conservative side of reality. We had an economist, Ross Garnaut, here in Australia, who was commissioned by the then Labor government in 2007 to 2010 to do some work on carbon trading and policy. And he wrote a devastating critique in one of his reports where he said, reality, the climate change reality is always on one side of the predictions. And if in any science, the observations are not in the middle of the predictions, it means the predictions are too conservative. And that is now well understood by both scientists and commentators. I mean, one of the really great examples is that, I mean, for a long time in policy-making terms, and the IPCC is not just science, it's politically influenced science. I mean, for example, until Paris talked about 1.5 degrees of warming as a target, the IPCC actually hadn't documented the paths or the impacts of 1.5 degrees. So the IPCC actually followed the politicians into looking at that. But we've always accepted that 2 degrees would be a reasonable target. And yet we now have circumstances where, in a paper, perhaps you have already talked about it in your program, the paper on hothouse Earth, which came out a month or so ago, where scientists said that if you get to 2 degrees, you may trigger feedback from the system that will take warming much higher, for example, towards 3 degrees. So even getting close to 2 degrees might trigger, if not runaway warming, accelerated warming that would move beyond the capacity of human action to slow it down. So I think the scientists, whether it be Sheldon Hoover in the Fortier report or others, are increasingly concerned that the IPCC is too conservative. Many of them are privately saying that the coming 1.5 degree report will be so conservative as to be, in my terms, a political fix. So that's the problem we're looking at.
Well, I always remind myself when I'm reading an IPCC report that somehow oil-dependent governments like the U.S. and Canada and Saudi Arabia all agreed to the wording line by line. And, you know, should we really depend on Saudi Arabia for our climate policy? I don't think so.
This is exactly the point. The original big volume reports are put together by scientists, and I think they in themselves are conservative and reticent because they're run by modellers. They have an eye to the political issues, I think. But when you get to the summaries that come out of the IPCC report, called the summaries for policymakers, they are actually voted on sentence by sentence by diplomatic representatives of the 180 or 90 countries who represent the IPCC. And yes, the United States, Russia, Saudi Arabia can veto line by line what those reports say. So the SPMs are incredibly conservative. And there's actually some stories around at the moment that for the coming 1.5 degree report, it may not come out in an SPM form. It's due on Monday week because the Saudis and the Americans are just sitting on their hands. So this is politically mediated science communication.
Where I live in Canada, it's frozen. A lot of Canada is frozen, and there's organic material from ages past frozen in there with it. It's like an icebox full of old food. And once that starts to thaw, there's going to be a stink, as gases like methane and carbon dioxide, which doesn't smell, but they're all released. And you have a whole section in your report, What Lies Below, on permafrost. Why?
Because this is one of the stories that's not being told. The IPCC reports, for example, give us carbon budgets about how much carbon we can burn for various degrees of warming. And none of those budgets consider that the permafrost will become active and release, as you say, carbon dioxide and methane to the atmosphere, which would reduce the amount of budget if the climate system is becoming less efficient at holding carbon either in the oceans or in the land. They assume that is not active, and yet we have clear evidence that it already is. So this is a systemic underestimation of the problem. And you know, there's credible science saying that in the next 10 or 20 years, the release of greenhouse gases from the permafrost could be sufficient. And once it starts, it basically becomes self-generating and self-sustaining. It could become enough to negate half of the world's land carbon sink at the moment. So this is just one of those hidden issues that really undermine the far too conservative estimates that on which policymakers are making their decisions.
Yes, I have a new interview with the French scientist now in Austria, Thomas Gasser, and he's just published a paper in Nature Geoscience in September. And it says that the amount of greenhouse gases coming out of the permafrost is really dependent on the emissions path that humans take. But he does say that permafrost has already begun to thaw, and he cannot see any way that it can be stopped once started. And that's just one tipping point, isn't it? What are some others?
Well, look, the climate system stores carbon in a number of places. Obviously, it stores it in permafrost, which is frozen carbon-rich material. It stores in the ocean. The carbon dioxide in the atmosphere mixes with the ocean and is drawn down. It's obviously stored in trees and all plants who undergo photosynthesis and take down carbon dioxide. And it's actually stored in the ground as well, whether it be through particular farming practices or other forms that store soil carbon. Now, all of those processes are not fixed. They are all changeable. And we've just talked about permafrost. We already have evidence in the Amazon, which is, you know, a very large store of carbon, that with climate change, parts of the Amazon are drying. It's getting less rainfall. You're getting more wildfires in the Amazon. And the capacity of the Amazon to store carbon is decreasing. We also know as the oceans warm, their capacity to store carbon dioxide is reduced. So these are some of the issues that are really not incorporating the thinking about where warming might go. And the other issue, of course, is that parts of the climate system are what we might call linear. If there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we know the temperature will go up. As the temperature goes up, for every 1 degree, the atmosphere will store 7% more water vapor, so you can get heavier rainfalls. As the atmosphere warms, you can get stronger winds and hence stronger cyclones, and not necessarily more of them. So they're linear responses, which are well understood by the models, but there are non-linear events where elements of the climate system literally flip from one state to another. A great example is the West Antarctic ice sheet, where early IPCC reports said this will be stable for 1,000 years. And that was generally accepted. And yet in 2014, we had a report coming out by Eric Rigneau and his fellow researchers saying, we think that some of the glaciers in West Antarctica have already passed their tipping point and no further perturbation or heating the system would be necessary to produce a 2 to 5 metre sea level rise. Now, these nonlinear events, a bit like the triggering of permafrost, you can't see in advance, but once they happen, you can say, yes, I can see when it happened. And this is the problem, because these are not things that can be easily modelled or predicted, and it means we should be very precautionary in how we think about climate change and its future risks.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I am Alex with my guest, Australian author and climate activist David Spratt. We're talking about Climate Code Red and the report What Lies Beneath. You have a new blog post. Well, it's an updated blog post titled IPCC's Political Fix on 1.5 Degrees C Will Undermine Its Credibility. What's the report and what is the problem with it?
The report was commissioned out of the Paris Agreement. In 2015, policymakers got together, and under pressure from the small island states, what's called the High Ambition Group, rather than just saying we should aim for 2 degrees of warming or less, which has been the traditional position of policymakers, they said 1.5 to 2 degrees. And then they asked the IPCC to produce a report on 1.5 degrees. And that report is due on the 8th of October. The problem is it's trying to fit a square peg into a round hole because we know, for example, that we have no carbon budget left for 1.5 degrees. We already have more than 1.5 degrees in the system right now without putting another tonne of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And it's also arguable with the sort of feedbacks that we're talking about that there's no carbon budget left for 2 degrees either, which are a very sobering propositions because without large amounts of carbon drawdown, we're heading to a very bad place. But the IPCC report is trying to fudge these issues and produce carbon budget figures that literally don't exist. They're doing that by using too lower a climate sensitivity, which is a measure of how much the system warms with a given amount of release of greenhouse gases. They're doing it by not looking at the last 3 years of accelerated warming in their temperature baseline and so on. And there have been a lot of scientists who have seen the reports just tearing their hair out and saying to us, I can't say it really publicly until the report comes out, that saying we think that this report will maybe even destroy the credibility of the IPCC because it's become too political. And that's before Saudi Arabia, the United States and their friends get to vote on the summary for policymakers. So there's growing evidence concern that the politicisation of science has destroyed the IPCC's credibility.
Right. If you want to get steam coming out of my ears, just start telling me about all the gigatons of carbon we can keep on burning in the coming decades.
That's right.
I think it's just so delusional.
Look, Alex, I think the other thing you need to think about, and it's the point you make in the first part of our report, is how we think about risk. You and I know that in engineering today, whether it be an aeroplane or a bridge, we have very low tolerances for failure. I mean, you wouldn't have, an aeroplane has got a, whatever it is, a 1 in a million chance of falling out of the sky in its lifetime or in every 10 years. We don't drive or walk across a bridge if you think there's a 1 in 10 chance of the bridge collapsing while on it. We are very risk averse. Yet you think about climate policy, you know, we keep on hearing these things saying, oh, we've got so much carbon budget for a 50% chance or a 67% chance it's not exceeding 2 degrees. And everybody says, oh, well, that's okay. What they don't understand when somebody says we've got a 50% chance of not exceeding, for example, 3 degrees, is you actually in that have a 10% chance of exceeding 6 degrees, which is the end of human civilization. So in the way we think about risk and climate change, we're not adopting the precautionary approach to risk management we do in every other aspect of our life.
And also really obscene to me, what is overshooting the climate? What's the plan there?
Well, this is a sort of, I would say, a political fix that came out of the Paris Agreement because Paris, under political pressure quite rightly from the small island states and others, said we should try and keep warming to 1.5. Now, 1.5 degrees is really not safe. I mean, we have one of the great wonders of the natural world in Australia, the Great Barrier Reef. Up to 3 years ago, half of that had been lost through a variety of factors. And then extremely unusually warm waters around the Barrier Reef over the last 3 years actually reduced its area by half again. So the Great Barrier Reef is now down to a quarter of its size 30 years ago. And we have research from here in Melbourne, where I'm based, saying that those wars that we had 3 years ago, the chance of that happening in the future, just at the current level of warming, is about 1 year in 3. So the reef is likely to bleach 1 year in 3, and it takes 15 years for coral to recover. So this is a death spiral for coral reefs everywhere at the current warming of 1.1. So 1.5 is not safe. Perhaps half a degree is safe, as Jim Hansen has been saying for 2 decades. But they had that 1.5 degree target in Paris, and then they try to show how you could get the world to 1.5 degrees of warming. Rather than saying we've already passed it, what they said was, well, we can keep on emitting greenhouse gases for another 30, 40, 50 years, and then in the second half of the century, we'll draw all those excess gases down by a thing called bioenergy, these carbon capture and storage, BECCS, which means that you pump large amounts of liquid carbon dioxide back into the oil and gas wells where the fossil fuels came from. But that scenario is not 1.5. It means going towards 2 degrees of warming and then trying to get back down. So when they say here's a 1.5 scenario, what they're really saying is here's a 2-degree scenario that we hope we can get back down to 1.5. But people don't understand that overshoot idea when they hear these figures.
So let me get this straight. The official plan, agreed by over 190 governments, is to load up our atmosphere with enough carbon to blow up our climate and then hope our kids can fix it.
To get us to two degrees, which might be a hothouse earth and feedbacks kicking in that will take us much higher, yes.
And then our kids are supposed to fix it.
And then we fix it by a technology called BECCS, which bioenergy, which the fossil fuel industry love, because it produces a market in liquid carbon dioxide as large as the current fossil fuel oil and gas market. So it's their money future. But that technology does not exist at scale, has not been proven, and is probably going to be very expensive. I mean, we do know that there are ways now to get carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Some researchers in Melbourne have shown that the restoration of degraded forests is by far the most effective and cheapest way to start doing that task now. But that's not being funded to the degree that it should. So, yes, we are deferring the problem so that a business-as-normal economic model can proceed for the next few decades.
I've just looked into that, and we've had guests who say, yes, tropical forests, they are a carbon-sucking machine, but we've had record deforestation in 2016 and 2017, so we're going the wrong way on that one.
Well, we've got deforestation, and then we've got the weakening of forests due to climate change, so there's two processes at work there. But, I mean, the opportunity is there to change this. I mean, in parts of the developing world, deforestation is an economic imperative, to put it mildly, particularly when a country is owned by the military and they get the whole of the land if they want with it. But I mean, it is certainly true that if sufficient revenue is put into those countries to give them another alternative, they wouldn't do it.
Well, there are a few scientists shouting out about our dire situation, and I've had some on the program, Michael Mann, Kevin Anderson, and others. They call for the three levers approach. Now, we don't have a lot of time, but could you briefly just point to what those three levers are, David?
Well, look, they say, first of all, carbon dioxide, which stays in the atmosphere for a long time, when you put carbon dioxide up there, a quarter of it's still there in 1,000 years' time. We have simply got to stop emitting carbon dioxide to make the problem worse. That's the first lever. The second lever is that we put a lot of what are called more short-lived gases, things like methane, which last 10 years, nitrous oxide, which lasts 100 years. We're putting them up in the atmosphere. If we stop them, then we would actually reduce the amount of heat in the system. So that's really important. So that's the second lever, the short-lived gases. And the third lever is to find the means for the deforestation, soil carbon at large scale or new processes which we can innovate to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So the three levers are stop carbon dioxide production, lever number two, reduce the short-lived gases, draw down the gases.
We are allegedly really intelligent. Can't humans just adapt to this coming warmer world?
Past a certain point, no. We've spent a lot of time over the last 18 months looking at what are called the existential risk, is a risk which would essentially bring human civilization to a change as we know it. Now, Professor Kevin Anderson, who you interviewed, is on the record as saying that, that 4 degrees of warming would be incompatible with the maintenance of human civilization. Professor Sheldon Huber, who we talked about earlier, who wrote the Fortier report several years ago, said if you got to 4 degrees of warming, the carrying capacity of the planet would probably be 1 billion people. And this is well understood. I mean, in fact, there's now work out saying if you got to 3 degrees of warming, you'd be in serious existential risk. I mean, think about it, 25, 30 metres of sea level rise, how many nations would disappear? 1 metre of sea level rise will flood 20% of Bangladesh, 30 million people. 1 level of sea level rise will flood half the Mekong Valley, which is Vietnam's food source. 1 metre of sea level rise will take out a large number of coastal cities around the world. So it is clear that in the 3 to 4 degree range, we are talking about the end of human civilization as we know it. And yet the Paris Agreement, as we discussed earlier, is currently a warming range of 3 to 5 degrees. So we are on course for, if not the complete end of human civilization, changes to which would make our society now unrecognizable in 100 years' time.
Well, here's what I want to know. Should I still take my dream trip to Greece or buy a heavier pickup truck?
I think you should sit on top of a mountain and take a whole lot of CEOs from the world's leading countries and sit there until you think about it deeply and for a long time, and they see the light coming out of the mountain then the next morning.
Yes, you see, my question was half serious because we are so straddled between a pretty comfortable present for most of us and a surreal future that you and I have been talking about somewhere over the cliff. It's enough to drive us crazy, and I wonder if we're not starting to experience a kind of pre-climate stress disorder.
Look, we are, and psychologists are pointing to that. Even in Australia, we've had a very severe drought in eastern Australia, which has affected a lot of our farming community, and the suicide rate goes up. I mean, this is in part a climate warming-driven health impact, so that is true. I mean, I think there's almost a psychological feedback that because the climate policy-making system is so wedded to a business-as-usual approach, not accepting that we actually face an emergency, need emergency action, the worse the problem gets, the more policymakers want to ignore it because it would actually upset the apple cart, the policy-making apple cart which they sit in. So, yes, I think those processes are at work, and the real issue is that whether it's in politics or in business, our time horizons have shortened from decades to years over a recent period. I mean, businesses used to think 20, 30 years ahead. Now they have 3-year investment horizons. It's the short-term nature of things which is really our enemy.
David Spratt, you've been ringing the code red alarm for some years now. What keeps you at it?
Well, people say climate change is all about fear or hope. You know, should we be positive and just say it's all right and look at renewable energy or be drowned by the fear? I don't think it's either. I think what probably keeps me going, you going, is the courage to speak the truth to the circumstances we face, because we know this is going to have a devastating effect on both human and natural systems, and that's something that's so morally disturbing that we just can't sit by.
Right. Do you have any new projects to tell us about or final thoughts as we wrap up here?
Well, look, I think one of the interesting things is we've been thinking a little bit how you talk about climate change to conservatives, because obviously in Australia, a very large fossil fuel producing nation, of our 5 main exports, they are in order roughly iron ore, gas, overseas tourism, and foreign students flying into Australia. So we're very fossil fuel dependent, and we're very partisan politics, as there has been, is in the United States and has been in Canada. And I think it's really interesting to think about climate change and pitching climate change not as an economic opportunity, not framing it as a green or environmental issue, which I think has been disastrous in terms of creating partisan politics, but actually to talk in the way we have. The duty of the government is to protect the people. The people are now going to suffer an existential threat. And what are those consequences? So it's not an economic debate. It's not a green versus non-green debate. It's a debate about whether human civilization will survive. And we have found that that discussion has been quite effective in engaging conservatives more than some of the traditional framings.
From Melbourne, Australia, we've been talking with author and climate writer David Spratt. You can find his work at climatecodered.org and look for his report with Ian Dunlop called What Lies Beneath. I will put links to all that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. David, thank you so much for spending time again with us.
Great pleasure, and thank you very much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.